So I'll announce you. Right, everyone. No, I need the mic, don't I? You won't have access to that. But so before we start, my two has an announcement on behalf of the CompSoc, of which I presume you're all members. So. Great. Okay, so let's get back to classification with Gaussians. And I noticed only at very last minute that there was a problem with the PDF on the slides. So I'm using last year's slides, which have a slightly different example, but doesn't matter. And they're also these are also on the web page now. As a bookkeeping type of announcements, you presumably have received an email from me with the coursework details and data files. It's been pointed out that you couldn't get the data files from the website, and that was something that exercised me and support quite a bit, and then we discovered we had put, well, I had put an extra slash in the link. So now you can get everything from the website, as well as having everything in your inbox. Now, classification with Gaussians, a topical theme, as you will have seen, it's relevant to the coursework as well. Last week, we've introduced the Gaussian probability density function, and we've mused about why it's such a great thing, why it's a great way to deal with pattern recognition, because it basically summarizes the data in usually a small number of parameters, and in this way avoids issues of having to estimate, to have lots of data to estimate empirical distributions over bins. Today we'll go forward and basically explain how we're going to use this in the context of Bayes' theorem, and naturally what we want to do is to use this to build a classifier. Okay? This is not by any means the only use of Gaussians. Gaussians are a really useful thing, as I've stated more than once now. One of the things you can do with them is build classifiers. Okay? But you can do lots of other things. You can do clustering, you can estimate distributions, which to some extent is the same thing, and you can compute lots of useful things. Okay, so this is a little bit of a recap of the stuff we'd seen last week already. So in the case of one dimension, we've seen that we've introduced the concept of probability density function, because so far we'd only talked about probabilities over discrete spaces. If we have continuous random variables, we need a concept of probability density function such that the probability associated with an interval is given by the integral of the probability density function over that interval. And we've introduced a special probability density function which is given by this negative squared exponential, which is the Gaussian probability density function. And it's got lots of interesting properties in terms of central limit and being somewhat of a universal approximator for many, many distributions. And it depends on two parameters, the mean, which is basically where is the bell-shaped curve in your line, and the variance, which is how wide it is. If you have a higher dimensional space, then you start needing to think about distributions over multidimensional spaces. These are called multivariate. And basically what we need is a distribution of a vector. So what's the probability of a vector lying in a certain subspace of our n-dimensional space? Well, the density so the stuff we integrate, is given by this negative exponential of a quadratic form, where the probability density function now is parametrized by a mean vector and a covariance matrix. Okay? This is the way it looks like if you plot it as a surface plot, and an alternative way to plot functions of two variables is to plot curves of equal value of the function. So this would be the curves of equal value of equal probability density in the x1, x2 space. Okay, they're given by ellipses in this case. Well, they're always given by ellipses. In this case, they are, there is a strong correlation between the x coordinate and the y and the x1 and x2 coordinate. Okay. Now, one thing to be noticed is that since the probability of x and y is the same as the probability of y and x, that implies that our quadratic form has to be symmetric for permutations of any two arguments. Okay, and that implies that the covariance matrix has to be a symmetric matrix. Now, one thing I said at the beginning of today's lecture is that a great thing about Gaussians was that we completely avoid the problem of having to have data points in every single bin in which we partition our space, because we summarize with a few parameters, in the univariate case with two parameters, our data. Okay? And to learn two parameters, you need more than two points, but you don't necessarily need points spaced everywhere. If we are in higher dimensions, and particularly if we are in very high dimensions, then the Gaussian is still a fairly highly parametrized probability distribution, because it will need as many mean vectors entries as the number of dimensions, but crucially, the number of parameters that go into the covariance matrix scales quadratically with the number of dimensions. Precisely, it's given by n times n plus 1 divided by 2, okay, which is the number of entries, independent entries in a symmetric matrix. I briefly mentioned how we estimate these parameters for Gaussians. I didn't mention it. I just gave you formulae. Okay? And these are the formulae that you would obtain by maximum likelihood. Is everyone clear about what I mean by maximum likelihood estimation of parameters? Because it occurred to me during last lecture that maybe it isn't so clear, because I don't think I've formally explained it to you so far. But I know you've done things in Inf1A, and you've done things in Inf2D. You will do things that may make this clear. Do you know what I mean when I say maximum likelihood? No, people don't know. That's always a problem. Okay, so take notes then. What I am writing at the moment is the probability of a certain random variable I'm interested in. Look, I should probably use that board occasionally as well. So to be fair, since the majority of people seem to be biased towards this side of the class. And also that has the advantage that I start writing here in the middle. Okay. So we're interested in a certain random variable x, and we are writing a probability density for this random variable x conditioned on, say, two parameters, mu and sigma squared. Okay? Now, if you recall, and this I have said, when we were talking about Bayes' theorem, we had a term that involved the observations given the class, and we called that term the likelihood. Now, we could see that this is the probability of the observations given some parameters that we do not know. We call this term the likelihood as well. So if we have lots of observations, x1, say, to xn, and we assume they're independent, then we could write a global function that is called the likelihood, which would be the product, since they are independent, over I of P of xi given mu and sigma squared, okay? Now, products, all of these numbers, well, these numbers may be smaller than 1. If we were dealing with real probabilities, they would be, but this is a probability density function. It doesn't need to be smaller than 1. But products can always give you trouble. That's a golden rule. So often we look at the log likelihood, okay, which is the log in whatever base you want. What matters is that there will be a sum of terms. Okay. And now let's assume that these PIs are P of XI are Gaussians. Now the Gaussian density function is, stay with the scalars for the time being. We get a factor 1 over square root of 2 pi sigma squared. Well, let's put minus n over 2 log of sigma squared. That's, you know, each term has got a normalization constant in front of it. And then we have the sum of the quadratic form, so plus sum I equals 1 to n of xi minus mu squared. Okay, of course, plus, but they all have a minus sign in front of them. And all I do then, how do I interpret this function that I've written? Well, this tells me, basically, for a given value of the parameters, how likely are the observations? So a natural way of setting the parameters is saying, well, I don't know these parameters, but I've got these observations. Presumably, these parameters are such that these observations are not so extreme. So the natural way to do things is to say, I'll choose the parameters that makes the likelihood of my data maximal. Okay? So what you do, you take this objective function, and you maximize it with respect to mu and to sigma squared. What happens if you do that? Let's maximize it with respect to mu. Well, how do you maximize things? Well, first of all, you observe that this, in terms of mu, is a sum of quadratic terms. So it is a quadratic term, and as such, it's got only one stationary point. And that stationary point is going to be given by zeroing its partial derivative with respect to mu. If I differentiate with respect to mu, this goes away. The 2 sigma squared doesn't matter. Even the minus sign doesn't matter. And I still get a sum. I can go inside the sum. Okay. Derivative of a quadratic is, well, what is it? It's, yeah, with a 2, not that the 2 matters. Okay, and then it would be the derivative of what is inside, but that just gives us a minus sign. It cancels that minus sign. So this is equal to 1 over sigma squared, which I can ignore because, you know, if it is 0, if I multiply it by a constant, it doesn't matter. Mu is the same, so I get n times mu minus sum I equals 1 to n of xi. Okay? And then that has got to be equal to 0, and that's going to be equal to 0 if and only if mu is equal to the empirical mean. Okay? Mu has got to be equal to the sum of the xi's divided by n. Same story, I could set the derivative equal to 0 for the with respect to the variance, and I would get that it's got to be that estimate. Now, someone in a tutorial asked me, but last year, we were told that the estimate of the variance has got 1 over n minus 1 in front of it. Yeah, is that the case? it is the case. Now, it turns out that what you get by maximum likelihood is a biased estimate of the variance. Okay? So maximum likelihood slightly underestimates the variance. By biased, I mean if I generate data from a certain distribution, and I generate, let's say, 200 data sets of size 100, okay, and I know the true parameters which I've used to generate the data, if I use these estimation methods, do I actually recover, on average, the true parameters? Turns out you do recover the true mean, but you slightly underestimate the variance. So the correct, the bias-corrected way is to make the variance, the coefficient 1 over n minus 1 instead of 1 over n. That's a subtlety that statisticians get very worked up about. But you know, thank God we're not statisticians. So I'll just use 1 over n. But what I'm saying here is these are the maximum likelihood estimates. The reason why we like maximum likelihood and why I talk to you about maximum likelihood is that for the Gaussian, we know how to correct the bias. For all other distributions, we don't know how to correct the bias in general. But we can still do maximum likelihood. So maximum likelihood is kind of a general purpose parameter estimation method. Okay. In the Gaussian, it gives rise to these formulae. Okay, so what, if I had data, what would I do? Okay, say I have two-dimensional data. Well, I just compute from that data the estimate of the mean, the two-dimensional mean, and the estimate of the covariance, and I fit it. Okay, and you could see perhaps that you know there are a few more points outside the three standard deviations than you would expect. So maybe we have really underestimated the variance. Now, what about Bayes' theorem? Now, there is a subtlety here. I've proved, well, or I've stated at least, the rules of probability for discrete random variables. I haven't done so for continuous random variables. It does turn out that the rules of probabilities also apply to probability densities. Okay? So it makes perfect sense to say what is the conditional probability density of x given a value of y. And it turns out that the joint probability density of x and y is given by this conditional probability density times the probability density of y. It also makes perfect sense to mix probabilities of discrete variables with probability density functions of continuous variables. So we can say what is the conditional probability density of x given class z. Okay, class z is a categorical discrete variable. And we can also define Bayes' theorem for this hybrid situation. And that's what we want to do. Okay, if we want to do classification, by definition, we have some classes which are categorical variables, are discrete, and we want to estimate the probability of the class given the data. The data in this case is continuous, so it's somewhat fortunate for the purposes of this lecture that we can do these things. Okay, I'm not going to prove it, but we can do it, and there are proofs out in the, you know, on the web or in the library. There's lots of proofs of this. So basically, the rest of the lecture, what we're going to do is to elaborate on this last formula, okay? Now, in practice, what are the steps we will need to take? Suppose we are in a univariate case for simplicity. Typically, we will have a modeling decision that our data comes, for each class, the data comes from a specific Gaussian. What we mean by that is that, say, if we have two classes, there are two different means and, in principle, two different variances. So given training data, we will be able to estimate by maximum likelihood, for example, these parameters mu c and sigma squared c on each class, on the training data for each class. And then once we get a new test point, x, we can compute the likelihood of this test point given the parameters that we've learned by maximum likelihood. We can look at the posterior probability of the class, which is going to be proportional to the log likelihood plus the log prior probability. And eventually, we'll be able to compute posterior log scores, odd scores. Okay. The reason why, we're looking at logs here, as we did in practice, we would do in any case, is just to avoid underflow problems. Okay. But also because it's kind of nice to work with these quadratic forms as opposed to exponential of quadratic forms. Okay, because this number, the exponential of this becomes very small very quickly. Okay, so this would be an example. I'm not sure whether we have the time to go through it in detail on the board, because we've already shown what maximum likelihood means, which was a little bit of a detour. But suppose we have two classes with certain observations. Well, what we're going to do is to, given class S, we estimate the mean of class S. That is easy, because it's we sum all these vectors, and we get 60 divided by 6 is 10. We estimate the deviation by taking, basically, this would only consist of three terms. It would be 11 minus 10 squared, which is 1, 11 minus 10 squared, which is also 1, and 10 minus 8 squared, which is 4. So we would get 6 as the total square distance, the sum of the square distances from the mean. We divide by n, which is 6 in this case, and we would get 1 again. And we could do the same thing for class T, and that gives us two Gaussians. We can plot them. Notice that the parametric assumption tells us a lot about regions where we don't have any data. We've never observed any data in this region here. But the assumption that we have a Gaussian distribution allows us to predict far from the data. It also gives rise to some interesting predictions, non-trivial predictions, that, for example, the probability of T, the probability of X given T is greater than the probability of X given S in this region. Okay. That's not something that would have been so intuitive, perhaps. So if we build a classifier, well, we can use these estimates to build a classifier and compute the likelihoods under both classes of these, multiply by the prior, and see. So if we assume that the two classes have equal probability, okay, let's say, where will x1 equals 10 be classified? Okay, that is easy. They have equal prior probabilities for 10. It's the likelihood of S is much higher, so we would certainly classify that as S. What about 11? Well, 11 is a little bit trickier, perhaps, to locate precisely. We are near the boundary, so we would have to compute that, of course. The other interesting case is 6. And now 6 is here. And although the mean, 6 is slower than the mean of the S class, as I've pointed out, the T class is more spread. Now, Gaussians really do not like things to be very far from the mean. And very far means in terms of how many standard deviations you are. Standard deviation is the square root of the variance. So this, at 6, is actually more standard deviations away from the mean of the S class than from the mean of the T class. And hence, a posteriori, we believe that it is in the T class. Because the T class is a little bit more lenient in terms of deviance. OK?
right? So this is what you would do
on paper. You would compute the log odds of the posterior probabilities. These terms, we've assumed them to be equal. And so you take the log of the ratio, which is, of course, the difference of the logs. These terms go away. And then we get a well-defined expression,
okay, which we can evaluate for every value of x.
What's more, given the posterior, given the prior probabilities and given the two class conditional probabilities, we can just plot the log odds. Okay, so we don't need to recompute it for every data point. We have a functional form for it. That's a major advantage compared to, say, empirical distributions like the ones we used for the fish. That is a functional form. Okay? In log space, it is a quadratic, as it should be, because it's the difference of two quadratic terms. And it tells us, basically, that around 9, we have the maximal odd for being in the S class with respect to the T class. And when we move away from this, we quadratically decay in log space. Okay? So if I am at 6, I can read here that the log of the ratio between the posterior probabilities is about minus 2. So we're about 100 times more likely to be in the T class than in the S class. If I am here, on the other hand, at about the maximum, the log odds of being in S, and this is probably natural log, so it was probably e to the 2, minus 2, not 10 to the minus 2. Here, the log odds is about 1, and that means that I'm about e times more likely to be in the S class than in the T class. So basically, I just plot this function, I get a new point, plug it here, evaluate the function at that point, and that gives me the classification. It's extremely simple. What if I had unequal priors? Well, it's not a big deal. This term cancelled before because we had equal priors. If we have unequal priors, we just get a constant. Okay? So we shift. Having a constant means that we shift up or down this particular curve. In practice, the maximum ratio would be, the maximum ratio would still be in the same place. But it could be that by altering the priors, we will never classify anything as the S class, for example. So you see, if I've this was the original curve where I had equal priors. If now I start saying that the S class has got a lower prior probability, 0.3, I've shifted it down a little bit. And the amount by which I've shifted it down is the log of 0.5 minus the log of 0.3. Okay. Now, that was all for the univariate Gaussian classifiers. What about multivariate Gaussian classifiers? Pretty much the same stuff, except that now we are in multi-dimensions, okay? So we get a log posterior probability, which is given by this formula. If we want to do classification, then we have to look at log odd scores again. And in general, when you move into higher dimensions, you move into computer. Okay? You don't do that many calculations in higher dimensions. So for example, if I have, this is a numerical example. We're loading some data into MATLAB. We're plotting the data. This is a scatterplot command. That's what it looks like. We have the three classes denoted by three different symbols. We estimate Gaussians from the training data. These two look fairly spherical. This one is more clearly elliptical. And then if we're given training data or testing data, for example, data like this, we can classify it. This is just a plot overlaying the estimated training distributions
over the test data, and then we can classify accordingly. This is the underlying true class. So as you see, I mean, we don't get everything right. So these, in theory, should all be circles. We will get a few crosses and a few X's as well. So the classifier makes mistakes, and that's fine. You know, actually, there has been a time in the history of machine learning where people were coming up with algorithms that were getting 100% accuracy, and then that was an embarrassing time because they realized that they were just getting very confident on the training data, but they weren't generalizing well. So no algorithm would get 100% on testing data. And then, you know, this is the same for class B, and this is the same for class C. How do we analyze results? So this is an important slide. Typically, you could say, what percentage of the training data I get correct? Or maybe I could look at which percentage of the test data I get correct if I have the true answer in the test data. But typically, you can look at the training data. And that gives you a feeling of how well, at most, you may be doing. So if the model was correct, the error rate on the training data should be roughly what you expect. There is something called the confusion matrix, which is a great name. And the confusion matrix essentially tells you how confused your algorithm is by the data. And it makes sense. You know, the confusion matrix tells you is a matrix made up of the true class. It's got as many rows and columns as a square matrix, with as many rows and columns as the number of classes. And in each entry, there is the number of examples that were in class A that have been classified as class A. Okay. So what is the sum of this column? What is the sum of the columns of the confusion matrix? Hmm? Sorry, I didn't get that. 100. Right. But in general, in this case it is 100. But what does it correspond to? So it corresponds to the true number of elements in each class. Okay. So in this case, the data had 100 points from each class, the training data, or the test data in this case. The sum of the rows is not 100. In general, because the sum of the rows gives you the number of points that were classified according to that in the class. And that doesn't need to be the same as the number of points that were really in that class. So this gives me the number of points in class A in truth, and this is the predicted number of points in class A on the testing set. In this case, it turns out to be slightly lower. Of course, the sum of all these nine numbers is 300, whichever way you look at it. But that gives you a slightly more detailed representation of the accuracy of your classifier. If you just report a percent correct, then it may be that one class you do really badly, but overall, the other two classes you do extremely well in terms of labeling them all in the right class. In some sense, you have some false positives. And you could still get a good percentage correct, but there may be cases where you really want to get the confusion matrix with big diagonal elements and very small off-diagonal elements. So that tells you what is a good performance. Okay. So the percentage correct would be the sum of the diagonals over the total sum of the matrix, while you may want each of these elements to be very small. And this is an example where we really want this. Okay. This is a real study. It's not a very recent one, so it's 30 years old now, actually.
It was carried out by a group of statisticians led by Mike Titrington, who has just retired as professor of statistics at Glasgow, and he was an eminent UK statistician. Basically, we have a task of using a Gaussian classifier to predict the recovery of patients. Okay? So this is a real application. There was some real data. You get patients coming into hospital, and we have some features about each patient. Okay? And the features are, they're actually discrete in this case, but we'll model them as continuous. The age, we have some clinical features in terms of how the patient responds to stimulation when he comes into hospital. And we have some other clinical features in terms of the motility of the patient. Okay? We have three possible outputs classes, okay, which you know are, you can comment, I mean they're evident what it means. And we have a data set with 500 training patients and 500 test patients. So the idea would be we have observed, we're a hospital, maybe we're a whole NHS, we have these standardized practices when patients get admitted with head injuries of recording the age, recording the some clinical features. We want to predict, we have observed in all these patients what was the eventual outcome. We want to predict automatically, given a new patient, what is the predicted outcome. And presumably what we want to do, if the predicted outcome is one or two, we want to really make good effort to intervene and change this from one. There is some imbalance in the classes, and this is an important feature, okay, and we'll come back to that. So we've only got a small percentage in the training data which corresponds to the class two. Okay. So the three classes is a little bit problematic. So a priori, we have different probabilities of ending up into different classes. So the approach that was used, another thing was that there were some missing values, but let's forget about that. So there were some training data where they didn't annotate the age or for whatever. But what they wanted to do was basically for each class, they trained a six-dimensional Gaussian. Okay? They estimated a sample mean and covariance, the class mean and the class covariance. And this may have been a little bit tricky because, you see, in the training data, we had only 50 samples in class two. We're trying to estimate a six-dimensional Gaussian, so we're not, you know, we can still do it because what we have 30 parameters in the covariance matrix, but we don't have masses of data. But nevertheless, that's what they did. And then they had some testing data, and they wanted to compute the accuracy on this testing data. Okay. To establish basically whether this simple Gaussian classifier would be an effective train to support decision in a hospital situation, an effective tool to support decision in a hospital situation. And that's what you got, okay? And this is an interesting result. So on the training data, this was the confusion matrix. So we do really quite well in predicting class one and in predicting class three. Big diagonal elements. We are a little bit optimistic, so we predict class three quite a few times when the actual outcome is class one, not so much in the other direction. But the key point is that we have a very, very little number here on the diagonal. Okay. So we don't have that much training data for class number two, and in fact, we get it wrong most of the times, even on the training data. And similarly, on the test data, the results are quite similar. So we can discriminate quite well between class one and class three, but not so much. Again, if we looked at the correctness, we have 77% correctness on the training set, 72% correctness on the test set, that would indicate that it is not such a bad model. Because basically the way it behaves on the training set is rather consistent with the way it behaves on the test set. However, on a superficial, just percentage of correct analysis, we would be tempted to say this is not doing so badly. But however, we're almost always misclassifying the patterns from class 2. And that is an example where looking at the confusion matrix really gives you some insights about the validity of this modeling approach. Okay, class 2 are probably the most important patients, which you really want to intervene about. Misclassifying them is not good. So I guess
Gaussian classifiers don't really pass the test for being used in a hospital. But this would be, you know, if we were to plot the decision regions, for example, between this is just wrong. It's about a few slides before. Forget about this slide. But there are some other areas where maybe they're useful. Hopefully situations where they're not so critical. And the example we have now is the example of vowel classifications, okay? So Steve Reynolds, who's been teaching this course for many years before, since up to last year, is a world-leading expert on speech recognition. And, of course, he's chosen an example where he knew what he was talking about. So there is a whole host of speech recognition and speech technology hard facts hidden here, okay? But basically, for the purposes of the example we have now, we have recordings of vowels. So people have been asked to sit in a kind of, you know, box room, very well insulated from external noise, and utter sounds like R, E. So you can probably take part in these experiments. They still do them. And they're extremely boring things, but they guarantee that you get several different individuals that pronounce the vowels. Now, why are we interested in having several different individuals? Yes, so not so much to recognize accents, but we want to build a system that works robustly. Okay, so we don't want a system that only works for, you know, Oxford-educated Southern English people that speak in a very different way from, say, Edinburgh or Highlanders and whatever. So we want something that is reasonably robust. So we want to collect data that reflects, to some extent, the variability in the population. Exactly. We want to recognize the utterance, the vowel. We don't want to recognize only the vowel as spoken in a specific by a specific person. So we need a wide set of samples. Also, there is variability between the same person. So typically, the same person gets asked to utter each vowel more than once. But then there is another problem, of course. We've seen how we can go from text to features that we can use into a classifier. The thing is even less obvious in terms of speech. Okay? Speech is a sound, it's not a number. And how do I plug it into a Gaussian that takes numbers as its input? And that's where there is all this technical part that I'm not going to go at all into it, but basically what you would do, you would record the sound wave, do some sort of fast Fourier transform, and extract spectral features, which are often called frequencies, and basically some specific, so the amplitude associated with some specific frequencies are the features that we're going to use. Okay? The data
that we're going to use is quite a classical data set in speech. It's this Peterson-Barney data, which you can probably find on Wikipedia as well. And it gives you recordings of spoken vowels by a number of Americans in this case. So this would be not adapted, not suitable for Scottish people, but vowels in American English spoken by people of different gender, different age, in order to account for that. Okay. The idea is we split this data set into a training set and a test set, and we want to compute a classifier. Okay. The way we will do it, in the training set we have examples for each class. We have transformed the audio data into numerical features, and we'll fit a Gaussian distribution, multivariate Gaussian distribution, to each class. Okay, we'll do this in the training set, and then we can do the testing. And we'll assume equal priors. So there are, the number of vowels changes from actual language to language. So for example, in Italian we have 7 vowels. In English we have 10. So here we have 10 classes with prior probability 1 over 10. Okay. We take bivariate data, so we just look at 2 frequencies, and these are the vowels that we look at. That's the way they're used by an American person to pronounce words like B or big, red, at, and so on. And these are the phonetic symbols. Well, they're not the phonetic symbols, but they're the way they're represented. Right, some more examples of audio data from the audience. So if I just plot the data, that's what it looks like. We've had to go into, I mean, I'm not expecting you or myself for that to be able to read what each symbol corresponds to, but as you can see, there is a substantial overlap between classes. For example, in this area here, we have a substantial overlap between the U and the U and the AU class, which is perfectly feasible. But the good thing is that it's not so incredibly overlapping as to make it obvious by visual inspection that the Gaussian mixture, a Gaussian classifier, will not do anything useful. So if I train the models, well, then I start. What I would need to do, I take the red balls, use them to estimate a two-dimensional Gaussian, plot it there, so on and so forth. Okay, just need to do 10 of these computations, and that's the kind of partitioning of the space that we get. Okay. So I would expect, from the training data at least, to be able to do reasonably well at classifying this E sound, maybe not so well at classifying the U sounds. Okay. This is the Gaussians without the data on top of it, and this is the test data. And as you can see, for the E sound, they would probably almost all be classified correctly. In fact, 20 out of 20 of the test classes get classified correctly. For the second class, again, we're probably going to be doing pretty well, except that some of them may be classified as the third class. But no, we're getting all of them right, essentially. Then we can go forward with this. Now, this starts to be a little bit trickier. So the EH class, we have data that is spread and goes a little bit into this other class and this other class. So we are misclassifying some. And this is how we proceed. We build a confusion matrix going through each Gaussian and through the test data set. So here, I know what the truth is for the test set, and that's why I can use a confusion matrix for the test set. Typically, I wouldn't know that. There are options for dealing with this problem, for example, splitting the training set into a training set and a validation set, and so on and so forth. And as we were observing before, we get a very good prediction on the E class because that seemed to be reasonably separated, but for the U class, we are getting slightly lower percentages correct. Overall, we get a good percentage of correctness, but there is some variability in between the different classes in terms of how accurate this classifier is. If we were looking on a training set, well, surprisingly enough, on a training set, the actual percentage of correctness is even lower than on the test set. That's not something that usually happens. Probably it's not truly Gaussian, the data. But at least we are not overfitting. So the really worrying thing is when you get 100% on the training set and you get 50% on the test set. That indicates that your model or the way you've trained your model is seriously wrong. These are the decision regions. Of course, I can plot in different colors. I have that my discriminant function essentially is a well-defined function. So what is the log odds for class one versus all the other classes? And I can plot with a certain color the region where that function is maximal out of all the 10 functions. And I get a nice colorful picture. OK. So this is the summary. The only concept that I've introduced today is the fact that you can still use the rules of probability and Bayes' theorem with PDFs, probability density functions, and with hybrids of discrete and continuous variables. Once you have that, building classifiers is reasonably trivial. You just do maximum likelihood estimation per class, and then you compute log odds. And you can. There are lots of examples where the Gaussian classifier has been used. So that's all for today. We'll look at discriminant functions next Friday. Hi, Clemens. Thank you for sending the link. So I'm not sure about, I haven't heard back from Hiroshi. He was saying that there may be money from the school, but my dealings with the School of Informatics recently, I've always indicated that there is never money. Now, we could put a case to Stuart Anderson, who's the director of teaching, that you would be developing a valuable teaching aid for Inf2B. Now, the obvious question that, would be asked is whether it would be the best way of doing it, or whether we should, if we really wanted a teaching aid, shouldn't we ask, a PhD student to do it in a week or something like that? So I think the remuneration question remains unclear to me. On the other hand, an alternative would be to get you to look at some more research type things. But then again, in that case, I don't know what funding there would be available to pay you. Now, if you wanted to work for free, then that's another matter, of course. We can always do with free labor, but that's, official government policy. So, if you wanted to kind of do get a flavor of some research projects, then you can certainly look into that. And there would be options, both with my group or with other groups, I'm sure there would be other people that would be interested. Things that we do regularly, we have, for example, data that determines the regions where a protein binds to DNA, for example, and the
data looks like a histogram because of technical reasons of how the data is generated. So essentially, it is counts of fragments of DNA mapped onto a certain region. And you know, we could want to, we regularly do things like clustering and either K-means clustering, we do other things more advanced as well, or hierarchical clustering. So it could be something that